This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners who support us on Patreon. Family members get ad-free episodes, merch discounts, live monthly trivia, monthly bonus shows, and pre-sales on live events. Live events like our Sunday, June 5th screening and podcast recording with Slate's Dana Stevens at Chicago's Music Box Theater. More information about that event at filmspotting.net/events. To become a patron, visit patreon.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Your instructor is one of the finest pilots this program has ever produced. His exploits are legendary.
Tell me about these exploits, Adam.
Those are classified, Josh. I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
Can you at least tell me who the enemy is in Top Gun Maverick? Just give me that.
Age.
That clip from the trailer for the long-awaited and long-delayed Top Gun Maverick. It does come to theaters this Memorial Day weekend, and yes, we have a review.
Plus Buster Keaton's Steamboat Bill Jr. and more ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting, Buster Keaton Marathon, Massacre Theater, Josh, blah, blah, blah. Let's get to Top Gun Maverick.
Okay, Dad.
Take me back to the southwest suburbs of Chicago, Josh. Summer 1986. How did Top Gun change a preteen Josh Larson's life?
We went into this, I think, when we did our Film Spotting live watch party of Top Gun, but did not land with me. It was a locker room movie, and I was not a locker room kid. I played sports and liked sports. That wasn't it. But the locker room was not my favorite part of playing sports, and that's how it registered to me. The bravado, the over-the-top forced bravado, the homophobic jokes, all that stuff. I was just like, I get enough of this after basketball practice. I don't need it even with the cool plane. So I've since come around. You know that. I'm a little kinder to Top Gun these days. But yeah, in 86, that's okay. Didn't need it.
So you're saying you and your best friend didn't decide that your 10 speeds were actually F-14 Tomcats, and rather than ride through town like normal people, you preferred to engage in breathtaking dogfights, your two sets of brakes allowing you to switch between guns and missiles? Of course, before streaking out of his driveway, a.k.a. our aircraft carrier, you'd say in unison, "I feel the need for speed," then high-five in that very specific and undeniably awesome way Tom Cruise's Maverick and Anthony Edwards' Goose do.
Me and my friends were more of X-Wing fighter guys.
Uh-huh. I suppose you're going to tell me that when your parents bought a chocolate lab, you didn't insist that his name be Maverick.
No. Scary. Okay, we had a scary.
Just me then. The point is that surely I am the target audience for Top Gun Maverick, the follow-up to the movie that made Cruise Hollywood's biggest star, a title he somehow still seems to hold almost four decades later. The sequel finds Maverick being ordered back to fighter weapons school, this time as an instructor preparing pilots for a mission, impossible, you see what I did there, that has something to do with destroying an enriched uranium site. Among his younger charges is none other than the unfortunately named Bradley Bradshaw, played by Miles Teller. Call sign Rooster, you know, like his old man. He was Goose. Brad Bradshaw, no, really, that's what they named him, carries a grudge against Maverick that only partly has to do with blaming him for his father's death. Josh, the shadow of Goose and his son, Brad Bradshaw's conflict with Maverick.
You love that, huh?
Isn't the only way the 86 Top Gun looms over this one. My personal favorite callback might be that Jennifer Connelly appears not just as a random former love interest, but the Penny Benjamin, the Admiral's daughter Maverick gets reamed for completing a high-speed pass over at the beginning of Top Gun.
Oh, I'm glad you connected. I knew she had to be somehow.
Of course she did.
Yeah, so I'm so glad that you did that for me. Thank you.
You thought something like that would go overlooked by me? No chance. As you said, you're the rare individual who came to appreciate Top Gun later in life. So I'm curious how you found the movie's balance of nostalgia and the new. Or maybe to put it another way, how many times do you think I've pretended to be dogfighting on my bike since exiting the theater?
On your bike or in your minivan? I mean, I think...
Either one.
Let's paint a more accurate picture.
How dare you?
Yeah, and by I've come to appreciate, let's say I'm mildly favorable, and what I like about Top Gun now is the things I didn't pick up on earlier, it's actually subverting some of that machismo, and subverting, more importantly, the notion of American individualism above all. I think it's interesting, the 86 movie, how it does kind of celebrate that and poke holes in that mythology. This one, I mean, I came out, all right, so listeners know I have a little bit of a history of doing this, so I'm going to put Top Gun Maverick in this category. Every once in a while, I find myself liking the sequel to a beloved hit more than the original.
Hmm.
So we're talking, let's get people riled up here, Adam. Rocky Balboa being better than Rocky. Predators. I'm sorry, Chris Klemek. Sorry, we've just lost
no
you.
No one asked. You could stop, Josh.
Predators is better than Predator. And Adam, I'm here to tell you, Top Gun Maverick is better than Top Gun. Now, it's a matter of degrees. I'm not losing my mind over this movie, as I've seen some, you know, fairly respectable critics do. It's really gotten better reviews than I thought it ever would have. But I am favorable on it. And I think it wasn't until the final third, to be honest with you, that I went that way. I was satisfied enough by what was going on up to that point. I think it handled its nostalgia fairly well. I think the model for this movie, and we can get into this, was Star Wars: The Force Awakens. It very much follows that pattern. I thought it was successful for the Star Wars franchise, though I'm less tied to the Top Gun films. I think it's a similarly successful pattern here. But then I did start to doze almost. I almost dozed off about the, you know, three quarters of the way through, because there was a lot of fighting, jet flying, a lot of cockpit point of view shots of the people flying the planes. And then we get to that last third and it starts to do something new. You've already mentioned how it calls back to the original movie. I mean, I thought the first 3 minutes, I almost thought, Adam, that they were using the same footage as the original movie. I mean, we get the text about the Top Gun school.
The same text
with the same Harold Faltermeyer and Steve Stevens original theme playing, right? Then we get the familiar tune of Kenny Loggins' Danger Zone over footage of these jets dramatically landing on an aircraft carrier, shot and edited the exact same way the original footage
they
was.
Wanted to make me comfortable, Josh.
I mean, we got comfortable. All right. I was confused. I thought Paramount Pictures was pulling a trick on me. Like, we're going to do sort of take the Psycho redo a step further and just basically drop the same film on these people and see if they notice. Of course, it does divert from that a little bit, but not very much. And again, going back to The Force Awakens, you know, even in the filmmaking, the editing patterns here are similar as they were in The Force Awakens. You got some scenes that were edited exactly like scenes from 1977 Star Wars. So all of that was, again, in line with the strategy used there. And you mentioned it in the Miles Teller character. We have, not only do we have Cruise returning, so a beloved original star, but then we have this younger generation who shows the qualities of the earlier characters. So to me, and you're more the expert, so you can tell me if this is off, Rooster, I went with the Rooster. I kind of thought, what is he? Brad Bradley? What is his real name?
You can't say Brad Bradshaw?
Brad Bradshaw. Thank you. Yeah, I went with Rooster. Rooster seemed to me to be kind of, you know, he's good-hearted. He's by the book. He's sort of a combination of Goose, his father, Anthony Edwards, and Val Kilmer's Iceman. And so that way it's kind of connecting us to our feelings for the other characters. All of that worked for a while, but it did get to be, because I'm not a huge fan of the original, at some point I started to feel like I'd crash someone else's high school reunion. And everybody else was having a much better time than I was. And I was kind of looking at my watch and saying, might be time for me to leave this place. Then that third act kicked in, which is pretty great.
Yeah, there is a lot of overlap, actually, in our reactions to this film, though some of the details aren't exactly the same. And ultimately, I suppose it's going to be ironic. You're kind of assuming there in your comments that someone with my background with this film would surely be more enamored with all of those callbacks and homages and the way it wants so badly to make us comfortable with those nods to the first film. And that's actually not really the experience I had. You know, I didn't think about it in these terms, but you mentioned The Force Awakens, and I suppose that is the right analogy here. Actually, as I think about it, I was rewatching the trailer for Maverick earlier today, the first trailer that went out, and it's a lot like, not The Force Awakens trailer, but one of the more recent films with Rey, where we get the voice, and she's in the desert, and she's waiting for that speeder to come over of her. It's just like the opening to this trailer where we hear Ed Harris's voice. He has a very small part in this film, and it's Cruise in the F-18 this time skimming across the desert. And actually, you know what? Everything about the plan here, their mission, feels like it's taken right out of A New Hope and
totally.
The Force Awakens, right?
Yeah.
With the setup itself to it, the difficulty of it,
having to hit the target.
They have to hit. I mean, it's all there. But as a defender of The Force Awakens, I'm someone who thinks that what that movie steals from A New Hope is a little bit more of an essence. I know it is more tangible than that. All the haters out there will tell me that. But I do think it's something more fundamental from a storytelling standpoint that that film understands and exploits versus this, which, Josh, you said it, for a while is just a collection of callbacks, and some of them kind of awkward. You said, though, despite that, you are with the consensus that this is a movie that is superior, maybe not far superior, but you're saying it's superior to the original. I'm at a loss, honestly, because the aerial scenes are more sophisticated.
Yes.
I get that. Great. And I suppose the other big reason is there is an 80s cheese sheen to Top Gun 86 that this film doesn't have. It is certainly much higher production value, and I don't think we scoff at a lot of the things that we do now when we watch Top Gun 86. But Joseph Kosinski is no Tony Scott. Visually, anything not involving jets in the air looks like a car commercial or a perfume ad. And just at the point where I was really thinking about how true that was, we get to the end of the film and there's a posed shot of two characters up against a Porsche that just really hit it home.
But isn't that drawn from what Scott was doing in the original?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And I think the reason why, Josh, I think that there may be something in the visuals themselves and the aesthetic that I would have to go back and watch that film again and really compare to break it down. But I think the disconnect is actually in what Tony Scott and that film gets right from a storytelling standpoint. And what this film doesn't get right in terms of storytelling and its narrative then amplifies the fact that it seems like just a collection of those callbacks, but also those really lushly shot car ad kind of tableaus. I just think, and I'll give credit, I suppose, to the original screenwriters, Jim Cash and Jack Epps Jr. Everything in terms of the storytelling, I just think is actually better. And here's my case for it, Josh. 86 is all about Maverick's character arc. All of those primary supporting characters and their relationships or their conflicts with Maverick are in the service of that arc, whether it's Edwards and his character Goose, whether it's McGillis, it's Kilmer's Iceman, it's Tom Skerritt as Viper. It is very streamlined and satisfying in that way. And here with Maverick, it's all driving towards resolution of that relationship I mentioned with Rooster, which is unwieldy enough. And the filmmakers try to connect the characters back to that central conflict. The writers here are Aaron Kruger, Eric Warren Singer, and Christopher McQuarrie, but I don't think they pull it off. So we get all of these recruits who we don't really care about, and characters like Connolly's Penny and that romantic angle, and Glenn Powell's Hangman, who, I get it, is supposed to be like if Iceman and Maverick had a love child.
Yes, yeah.
And he is a catalyst in some way for the Maverick-Rooster conflict, but he mostly feels like a character in need of his own movie, or at least a movie where he gets to be the Iceman-level antagonist and not fourth or fifth fiddle. This movie just feels bloated to me, and that's even before I really lean into how anchored down it is by that nostalgia and the nods to the original. That didn't work for me, which obviously probably is a surprise to you and many of our listeners, maybe even a surprise to myself.
I mean, I've got to regain my balance here. Are we actually having a discussion where you're giving a negative review to Top Gun Maverick and I'm giving a positive one? Or are you just saying you like it, but significantly less?
Yeah, I'm saying I like it, but significantly less.
Okay, good.
And I said that there was a lot of crossover. The reason I can ultimately recommend this film, this is a classic Josh Larson film spotting review, though, where I'm going to say I liked it, but I'm definitely going to spend most of the time talking about why I didn't completely love it. It is because of that third act. It's because of how fun it is once the movie realizes that the best thing about the film is Maverick being in a cockpit. Otherwise, Top Gun Maverick is 131 minutes of fan service where the fan isn't truly served until the last 30.
And you're saying they're not served because the thrills you experienced the first time around, you didn't get until that last third.
Yeah.
Basically. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question that you won't be able to answer. But do you think, as you're describing these other recruits and the dynamics at play and the storytelling, essentially, do you think if you saw Top Gun Maverick at whatever, 12, 10, whatever it was, that all would have worked for you? And is this more a matter of, you know, this being essentially a juvenile material and a narrative that as a grown adult is just not hitting you in the exact same
way? Maybe. I mean, it's hard to dispute anything about Top Gun not being juvenile, but the elements of the narrative that I think stand out to me and that I was trying to articulate are sort of classic hero's journey stuff that I think when done well, almost always works.
And you don't think that's here with Rooster?
No, I don't. I didn't fully realize how much the 86 Top Gun got that right until I was comparing it against this
interesting
big production.
Yeah. And so I will give you, it's such a slight thing that I don't even remember the details, but essentially the conflict between Rooster and Maverick is not really that Maverick was connected to Goose's death. It's
no,
because he pulled his cards or something.
Pulled his papers.
Pulled his papers earlier in flight training school and put him back a few years from advancing his career. And I will fully admit that pulled his papers thing did a heck of a lot of work. I kept trying to figure out, what did that mean? Why, you know, I know the effect of it, but why was Rooster so pissed about it? It was a very strange storytelling choice to not just have the conflict rooted. It's right there for you in Goose's death, and have them come to terms with that in terms of their relationship. And heaven knows, this is going to support your point, we know the details of Goose's death because this movie actually replays a significant amount of footage. That was the low point for me in terms of the, whatever you want to call it, fan service, nostalgia, all of the sequences with Anthony Edwards, the scenes that we had to watch again,
right,
reminding us. And then it doesn't even come into play in Rooster and Maverick's relationship because their main conflict, again, is about these papers.
Yeah. He uses that guilt against him, though, especially in one scene.
Okay.
But you're right.
Yeah. I guess it does come into play, but why not just use that, I guess, is my question. Because the papers thing seemed pretty flimsy overall. But I will say, I don't know, it does come back to how much that hero story, as you describe it, moved you and you revered originally. you're going to give it more weight than maybe what you see now. And I see the two films more on a similar plane in terms of what they're doing with that sort of mythology. And I think, you know, for me, maybe part of the appeal, and when I wrote about this, I didn't spend a lot of time on Cruz. And it was just, I just ran out of time, to be honest with you. But I think part of the appeal for me here is related to Cruz, considering his one of his most iconic roles. And this goes back to why I'm serious about Rocky Balboa being a Rocky film that I do really admire, because I like how Sylvester Stallone is doing something very similar in that film. Within the narrative, considering not only the character's legacy, but his legacy as a movie star is what I think Stallone is doing there. And I just find that more interesting than I do a lot of the other Rocky stuff that people love. And I think Cruz is doing something similar here. And it's just this consideration of how can he still be Maverick now, but be a different Maverick. And I did get a little thrill at the beginning of how he wanted us to really feel he was still Maverick. Did you notice that this is going to support your point about it being a advertisement, a TV commercial, but that whole sequence of Mav living in a hangar now, right? And we see his living room is right next to the plane, essentially. Yep. Did you notice how Cruz sat in the chair in that sequence? He's all alone. No one's there to watch him, but he comes, you know, strutting out towards his living room area next to the plane.
Doesn't he kind of lounge in it?
Well, he kicks his leg up completely over the back of the chair.
That's what I was
to pirouette of. And then sort of just like, yeah, lounge back into it. Now, any normal human being just walks up to the chair, to the front of the chair, and plops. Not Tom Cruise. Not Maverick. Now, that's a tiny detail, but I think it just keyed in to what Cruz was interested in about this movie, is exploring how this guy really hasn't learned the lessons we thought he learned in Top Gun. I think that's one of the things, one of our differences about the original movie. You do see it as this hero's journey, and I see it as, you know,
yeah, but a hero's journey doesn't mean he starts as a hero. Let's not digress. You have to go on the journey. There has to be an arc.
Absolutely. No, I agree. You see him in a different place at the end of the movie than I do. At the end of the original Top Gun, right? I guess that's what I'm getting at. And here, it's almost like, did Maverick forget what happened in Top Gun, right? He's like, he's pushing Mach 9 in the opening sequence we get in a different experiment that he's part of, a different test. Mm-hmm. And then he does the leg thing over the chair. There's comments. Someone says to him at some point, I don't like that look, man. About him making a choice, a Maverick style choice. What does he say? It's the only one I got.
Yeah.
You know what? That's the only look Cruz has needed. It's the only look Cruz has needed over all of these decades. And to me, I found that more interesting, I think, than the sort of formation of the iconic Tom Cruise that we get in Top Gun, which is undeniable. It's one of the distinctive qualities of the movie. But I'm really intrigued by the reconsideration of that iconic Tom Cruise that we get here in Maverick.
Yeah, I agree with you that that's one of the pleasures of this film. And I'm glad, I suppose, I got to see both of those incarnations of Maverick. Cruise is just a more formidable actor now. He was, you know, on fire then, and everything he did on screen seemed incendiary, but now he's more soulful. He is a little bit more naturally plaintive. There is that charisma to him, but there's a maturity that you get here, even with Maverick. And that's that great conflict. I mean, you mentioned that look and how it's the only one he has and he's pushing it. Maverick is gonna Maverick. He only knows to push that envelope. But the key there, Josh, is that he's alone in that sequence, right? So in that cockpit, he gets to push the envelope and he's really only putting himself at risk. But then there's that other great Maverick element to it, that juxtaposition, which is also there from the very beginning of Top Gun, which is that he points out the real reason he gets in that plane, or at least as significant a reason that he gets in that plane. And the Ed Harris character, who I really think is kind of silly here in this film, he's only in the beginning, but everything about it, I didn't buy at all. His whole thing about how he's only interested in drones and not pilots, and, you know, human beings are too annoying or whatever. this guy's like 85, and there's no way a man of his age and tenure would prefer machines to men and women in the military.
I thought we were going to get another one of my beloved drone movies for a while there, that was going to be the central conflict, but apparently
not. I mean, even if you could argue it's realistic, it's just a facile kind of dichotomy that I think this movie and the screenplay trades in too often. But remember what he says. He pushes it, but it's also about getting that thing airborne so it keeps that project alive. For all of those people, there's a reason why that character is someone who's so close to him throughout the film.
Yeah.
Is that there's a loyalty and there's a desire to make sure that his fellow man is taken care of. And it's not just about his ego, but if he can push it, he simply doesn't know any other way to exist. And so I like watching that older Cruise still have to impart that kind of desire on screen, even though we get that soulfulness to him.
Can I tell you another storytelling choice that I did like, that a relationship actually development that I think works better than Rooster and Maverick? And it's my guy, Val Kilmer's Iceman. He's here only briefly, but he's referenced before he gets his one scene frequently. Yeah. And we learn, just love this. He and Maverick are text buddies now. Right. I love the idea that we live in a world so many years later that Maverick and Iceman are just texting each other on occasion. But also, I talked about wanting justice for Iceman in the first film. How about the fact that Iceman wants justice for Maverick? That's what we've learned throughout. He's been his protector. He has risen in the ranks. Iceman has risen in the ranks and won't give away exactly all the details to this, but essentially has kind of been this protector beyond and above, who has kind of guided Maverick back when he's going full math, let's say, has kind of guided him back into the fold. And I thought that was a very effective storytelling choice. And I thought Kilmer, you know, gets a really nice scene here, a very sweet scene that could have been handled horribly, but I think it's handled quite well. And I think this choice in terms of the relationship of those two characters was handled quite well. And one of the things that I liked best about this movie.
I too appreciated Kilmer and that emotional exchange between Maverick and Iceman in this film. Top Gun Maverick is currently playing in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
We've already had at least one masterpiece in our Buster Keaton marathon, but I think we're about to discuss my personal favorite film of his. Our review of Steamboat Bill Jr. is next, plus Massacre Theater. Stay with us.
That's from the trailer for the new film Hit the Road, currently playing in limited release, and it hits Chicago this weekend where it's playing at the Music Box. It's the directing debut of Panah Panahi, son of the great Iranian director Jafar Panahi. The family road trip film debuted last summer at the 2021 Cannes Film Festival and has spent the last several months playing the International Film Fest circuit to great acclaim. You caught up with Hit the Road, Josh, and want to nominate it for our Golden Brick Award. Of course, listeners who have been with the show a while will remember that about a decade ago, we devoted one of our marathons to contemporary Iranian cinema, in that we included in that marathon two films from Panahi Sr., The Mirror and Offsides. Did you see any of his dad's influence in this film?
Sure. Yeah, it's hard not to think about those movies in our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon that we did. And The Mirror, I think that was your favorite, wasn't it, Adam?
One of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, yeah. You love The Mirror, and that one centered around a young child character, and this family includes a little boy who features prominently, so that came to mind. Of course, another film in our marathon, Children of Heaven, features a young brother and sister, so that too. And then just the fact that most of this takes place in a car. I mean, how many Abbas Kiarostami films have we seen that prominently, there are prominent scenes in cars? So a lot of touches here that were reminiscent of some of the Iranian cinema that I've been able to see. But also, and I know it's always sketchy to cite a Western artistic property when you're talking about maybe a non-Western film, but watching this for the first half at least, I felt like I was watching Waiting for Godot on the road, because you have this family of four, they also have an ailing dog in the car, who are on this vague, uncertain road trip. They don't set out, and the movie doesn't tell you exactly where they're going, why they're going there. You can sense some tension, but they also engage in a lot of nonsense dialogue and conversations that are teasing, and you also sense they're doing this because they don't want to talk about what's really going on. So you feel like you're in this vague existential space that reminded me of Godot. And then, of course, things do begin to come into focus. And I do have to say that the marketing seems to be focusing on that younger son character played by, and I'm going to do my best to get some of these names correct, Ryan Sarlacc. And the poster features him standing out of the sunroof of the car. Things get pretty intense in terms of what this movie, and I'm not going to spoil it for those who don't know, what this family has set out to do. It gets a lot darker than what I expected. This is not like a Little Miss Sunshine type, you know, film, which I think it's being a little bit sold as. I'm glad it wasn't, because where it goes is very challenging, but also very eye-opening about the realities facing Iranian citizens and how it does filter down to the personal and affect a mother and a father, a married couple, their son, the older son, who is maybe around 20 or so, who is driving the car actually in particular. So as far as Panahi being a filmmaker, and maybe why I'm thinking of this as a golden brick, man, is there a clear command of the camera here. An eye for landscape. I think another thing that probably sounds familiar from some of our films in that marathon, and an incredible affinity for performance. A lot of times I think newer filmmakers, we recognize the formal acuity they have, but sometimes maybe it takes more for them to get a good feel for performance. And maybe this is just brought out by the talent of the cast, but I'm telling you, the mother here, played by Pantea Panahiha, just incredible. Absolutely incredible in the way she lets us in on the sorrow that she is feeling because of the reality of what this family is facing. There are scenes where everyone is singing along to a song on the radio, and she is doing that too, but you clearly can tell she's doing it to kind of trick herself and put on a good face. And she's also letting us know her complete understanding of what is facing them and what that's going to mean for them. We talk about vision, filmmaking vision, when it comes to Golden Brick candidates as well. And there is one sequence of magic realism, I think, that is just completely stunning. I'm not going to spoil that, stands apart from kind of the starkness of some of the other filmmaking. So just a ton of good stuff going on here. I hope it expands beyond the limited release it's getting right now, so more folks have a chance to check it out. But yeah, that is Hit the Road, highly recommended from me.
Opening, as we said, here in Chicago this weekend and in select cities. If you see it, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Next week, we have a top five planned. Right now, we're calling it Top Five Movies for Graduates. We do both have kids in college, Josh, and I have a daughter graduating from high school this year. As we're taping this, she's about to go to her final day of high school. Her commencement is the next day. And of course, you were nice enough to appear last weekend at her graduation party. Not only that, but let's talk about gifts for a second. I mean, if you have the ability to be friends with Josh, invite him to your kid's graduation party, because among other nice gestures, how about that Varda set that you got for Sophie, the Criterion set? She spends a lot of time just staring at it. Forget watching it. She just looks at it.
Yeah, hasn't opened it yet. I know the feeling. I remember when we got the Wong Kar-wai, World of Wong Kar-wai set for the show. I didn't even want to open it. I just wanted to kind of enjoy the packaging for a while. So I'm very glad that hit a sweet spot for her.
This Top 5 was actually inspired by Sophie and her high school movie club. They meet once a week, and the instructor is a listener of the show and reached out wondering if we would provide a list of some movies, maybe even do a top five list. They actually did watch a couple of the ones that I suggested here as they got into the final few weeks of the school year. And again, we'll have to get into the criteria a little bit or how we're approaching it. We are calling it movies for graduates. That probably means most of the titles will revolve around characters who are either looking to graduate high school or possibly graduate from college, but we're going to give ourselves a little wiggle room.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at with this, is trying to figure out what that criteria is going to be, because I have 10 to maybe 20 titles circling in my head right now. I think at one point we were going to call this maybe films to show your college-bound kid or something. So I kind of have that in the back of my mind as well, which changes things for me a little bit. So
yeah.
I don't know where I'm going to land, but this has been a really fun one to even just let percolate in the background. And of course, we should probably send out a call on social media too and just see where listeners' thoughts are when it comes to this sort of topic.
I'll say what's driving my approach more than anything is thinking about the film that Sophie recommended to the movie club. And this might make my top five, so spoilers here. The movie Sophie recommended that they ended up watching that then propelled the instructor to email me was Coconatus Columbus. And that is a film where there is a character who is not graduating from high school or college, but she has, having just watched it fairly recently, she has just in the past year, I think, graduated from college. And now all of her friends are off at school and she's trying to decide what to do with her life, having not gotten out of her town. So one that kind of checks the box on high school graduate, but also in a way doesn't, definitely about a character in transition as our high school seniors are. And that was the impetus for our current deeply flawed film spotting poll related to our top five movies for graduates. We asked you, what is the best high schoolers in transition movie? And we gave you five options, one from each decade. So from the 70s up through the 2010s. And the options, Josh, were?
Well, from the 70s, you might have thought we'd go with American Graffiti, but nope. Sam and His Wisdom chose Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show. That's your 70s option. How about the 80s? Maybe Fast Times at Ridgemont High? Well, we offered Cameron Crowe's script and directing debut, 1989's Say Anything. 90s, probably everyone assumed this show was going to make Dazed and Confused the option. How about the 2000s? For that, we're giving you Terry Zwigoff's Ghost World. And then for the 2010s, we went with Lady Bird. Booksmart, another good option for the 2010s, but Lady Bird is the direction we went.
Yeah, can't compete with Lady Bird. Sorry, Booksmart. So far, it is Dazed and Confused poll to lose. Lady Bird is in second place. And yeah, we might talk again about some of these titles next week on the show, including that distinction between those two Cameron Crowe scripts from the 1980s. You can vote in our poll and leave a comment at filmspotting.net. We are going to get to the penultimate film in our Buster Keaton marathon in a minute. That's 1928 Steamboat Bill Jr. But for the final film, we're inviting you to watch it with us Sunday, June 5th, 3 p.m. live at Chicago's Music Box Theater. You and I will be there, Josh. So will Slate's Dana Stevens, other Chicago film critic friends and luminaries. And yeah, Buster Keaton on the big screen. We'll watch The Cameraman, which will include live organ accompaniment from Music Box organist Dennis Scott.
Dana, of course, is the reason for all of this. Her new book, Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema and the Invention of the 20th Century, that is available now. So we reached out to Dana and said we have to do something surrounding the book and involving Buster Keaton. She helped us curate this marathon, chose the titles, and she's going to be there. So we'll have a post-screening conversation about Keaton and her book, and we're going to share our picks for the Keaton Marathon Awards, something we do at the end of each of our marathons. Dana also is going to sign copies of her book. So if you don't have one yet, pick one up and bring it with you to the Music Box.
Yeah, we've already received some great suggestions for our award name, and that includes the Damvinos and the pork pies. So we'll have to cull through those options. If you've got a good one that you think we have to go with for our Buster Keaton Awards, please do email us. feedback@filmspotting.net. That event, again, is Sunday afternoon, June 5th at 3 p.m. Tickets on sale now, including a limited number of VIP tickets that gets you early access to the green room. You get to hang out with us and Dana and Michael Phillips and others, and of course, get priority seating for the screening. More info at filmspotting.net/events or right there on the main page of filmspotting.net. This week on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, it's part two of their Into the Raimiverse pairing, the new Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness with the 1993 entry in the Evil Dead trilogy, Army of Darkness, Matt Singer making a special appearance, former co-host of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. He's getting around, not only appearing on NPS, but I know he just appeared on a podcast with the Blank Check Boys, our friends over there. And I saw a tweet, Josh, something about maybe the longest episode, or at least in the top five of Blank Check history, that episode with Matt Singer.
That beat our Romancing the Stone episode?
Oh, man. Our Romancing the Stone episode, I think, is in their top five shortest. So a lot of Matt Singer out there, or opportunities to hear Matt if you are so inclined. The Next Picture Show is hosted by Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance to win a Film Spotting t-shirt. A couple of weeks ago, we massacred this scene.
Honey, you know that global warming problem? I've discovered how we can reverse it.
Tell me.
No, not now, lovey bumpers. There'll be plenty of time for that later. And my investigation into the assassination of JFK?
You found the evidence you were looking for.
Yes, I have proof. It's right here in my pocket. It's big, honey, really big. It goes all the way to the White House.
Do you want me to hold it for you?
No, it'll be safe right here. I'm in a jet. What could go wrong?
Oh, dead meat. We just couldn't be any more perfectly happy.
That was Heidi Swedberg and William O'Leary in 1991's Hot Shots, written by Jim Abrahams and Pat Croft, and directed by Abrahams. That massacre was part of our summer movie preview show. So why that scene from Hot Shots? Josh Ashenmiller in L.A. has a first-order connection to Maverick, obviously. Just like we all knew, Goose's Goose was cooked in Top Gun. Dead Meat's nickname let the audience know he was not going to make it out of the movie alive. Second-order connection. The main character in Hot Shots is haunted by his father's career as a combat pilot. That father's name? Buzz Harley, who shares a first name with the main character in Lightyear, another title in your summer movie preview. Sorry your on-air kiss didn't work. Better luck next time. Yeah, I guess that's what happens when we don't rehearse, Adam.
Exactly. W.S. Lockwood writes, the scene you massacred was from Hot Shots. P.S. So you're the other people who actually watched that movie. Awesome. Actually, it wasn't just us, as you're going to hear from Ryan Hatch in Cottonwood Heights, Utah. He and his brother also fans.
Hot Shots. Hot Shots. 1,000 times Hot Shots. My brother and I used to watch it and Part Deux at least once a week when we were younger. To this day, all he has to say to me is Topper in that perfect Valeria Galino accent, and I'm on the floor laughing. Sorry, Ryan, I couldn't pull that accent off. I don't have that memory. The obvious connection is the new Top Gun movie coming out, but it can never live up to Hot Shots. Those are some long legs. I just had them lengthened. They go all the way up. I'm just like massacring one of Ryan's favorite films
you
now,
are.
Apparently.
Tim Bieber, Pottstown, PA, says the obvious connection, it's so obvious, is that Bill Irwin plays Buzz Harley, Topper's father, in Hot Shots. He plays Anne Hathaway's father in Rachel Getting Married and saves the world with her as Tars in Interstellar. And Anne Hathaway is in the new James Gray movie, Armageddon Time, a sure summer blockbuster.
Wow. Thanks, Tim, for 13 degrees of Bill Irwin. My favorite game.
Josh, reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
That would be Justin Comiskey from South Pasadena, California.
Congratulations, Justin. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
Martin, look at me.
I am looking at you.
Now look at me the way I'm looking at you. Put it in your eyes. You're mine, asshole, without saying it.
How about this?
What are you telling me? That you're sleepy? That you want to go to bed?
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and I really don't think we need to give away any hints, Josh. Our voices certainly aren't going to help. I don't know what to do. I don't think we know what to do when we have to play a scene straight. No funny voices, no weird accent work. We just got to inhabit two really fine actors, including one who is the greatest of all time.
I mean,
or is in the conversation.
I would say has a distinct voice. It's certainly not funny.
Right.
I'm a little worried I'm going to over gravel. I'm going to add a little too much gravel.
I think that that is almost certainly a lock. And with that, you started off, so get the gravel ready.
Okay.
I'm going to give you the action. And action.
You don't know what you're doing, do you?
What do you mean?
You just blew $500. That kid has both arms and traction. He beats anybody in the room.
Yeah. Yeah, he could.
So I'll offer it to you again. I'll play him for $500. You don't know what to say, do you? Maybe I'm a hustler, maybe I'm not. You don't know, but you should know. See, if you know that, you know when to say yes. You know when to say no. Everybody goes home in a limousine.
So what should I say? Yes or no?
You should say no.
And
scene.
Scene. I don't know if you got the degree of gravel that you needed, but you did have just the perfect pace on that last line.
Thank you. I was aiming for that. And yeah, I think I might have under-graveled.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. You should know it, and you should enter, even if you're like Josh and somehow hasn't seen this movie. There's a hint. Feedback@filmspotting.net is the email. The deadline is Monday, June 6th.
It's criminal. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. Let's get to our Buster Keaton Marathon and 1928 Steamboat Bill Jr. This marathon is devoted to Keaton's work as a director and star from 1920 to 1928, a period of great artistic and financial independence for Keaton, also a period of great artistic ambition. That independence, unfortunately, came to an end with Steamboat Bill Jr. At the end of shooting, producer Joseph Schenck dissolved Buster Keaton Productions.
Like the previous marathon film, 1926's The General, Steamboat Bill Jr. was a hugely ambitious affair with elaborate sets built for the film and a costly action scene, a cyclone in this case making up a significant part of the film's budget. The film also contains Keaton's most famous stunt, the house frame falling around him. One thing we talked about last week with The General was the question of whether that film was even a comedy, as it mostly plays as an action film. We actually agreed it was essentially the Mad Max Fury Road of its day. But when The General did go for comedy, it uncomfortably used the wartime death of soldiers as a source for jokes. Steamboat Bill Jr. has a much more comic premise, with Keaton as the long-estranged, dandyish son of a macho steamboat captain. There is then much fish-out-of-water comedy before we get to that epic cyclone set piece. What did you make, Josh, of this last statement of Keaton's true independence as a director and star? And I guess, more pointedly, tell me why you've already earlier in the show dubbed this film a masterpiece, or at least maybe your favorite Keaton film.
Yeah, I mean, we could have that argument, but I feel more comfortable at this point saying it's my personal favorite. It all comes together for me in this one, and I've seen it a couple of times, so maybe that helps, but everything I love about Keaton is here. The character-based humor. I mean, you know this guy inside and out, right? From everything Keaton does here. And then you have the physical gags, just the smaller physical stuff, not even the big outrageous stunts, which we get to. We get that with the storm sequence. You have the societal commentary, a lot of stuff here about new technology with the new steamboat that's pushing his father's boat out in terms of business. And I think for me, we'll see. We're not done with this marathon yet, but this has the richest emotional anchor in terms of a personal anchor. Maybe the most I've felt since 1 week, you know, the young married couple who are trying to figure their way through their first days of marriage with this build your own house kit gift that they get. But this relationship between Keaton's character and his father, Ernest Torrance, is just so rich to me. It's way more unique than what we get in a lot of the marriages that his other movies end in. And you have that too, of course. You have the romantic interests. But there were just so many layers, and it develops, right? Where this father is waiting for his son to arrive expectantly, and when he arrives, he's something totally different that he didn't expect. He tries to form him into what he wants him to be, eventually recognizes that's never going to happen. And the way, you know, Junior realizes what his dad's expectations were and that he's never going to be that, but that doesn't mean he has to completely cast his dad aside. I just found it incredibly moving on top of all this other stuff that's going on. So this one is just it's just pure joy for me.
I didn't feel that relationship quite as much as you did, though. I agree it's probably the most interesting thing about this film, or at least the narrative. And what struck me is the way the movie really at the beginning leans into this distinction between the macho father and Keaton's character. I mean, we just used the word, what, dandy-ish, you know? And if you read anything about this film, you'll see all these different terms used, like foppish and educated and effeminate and all these different ways of saying it seems potentially that he's gay. You know, that's at least initially the inclination. And I base that off of the fact that there's the line we get in the text cards on screen at one point where they see him, you know, they've watched him walk by with his little mustache and the beret, and he's not the imposing figure they expect him to be. And then they're watching him try to entertain the baby in the carriage, but they don't have the context of the baby being in the carriage. And they just think, you know, he's a ukulele playing guy who likes to dance in a really not masculine way. And the father says to his sidekick or whatever, something like, don't say what I think you're going to say or what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like he stops him from saying that, something that you wouldn't want to be said out loud. And what ends up happening, though, is that the movie in its own way becomes a critique of that type of masculinity.
Sure.
And that societal expectation. We have fathers in the film who are both bullies, not just Keaton as Willie, but Marion Boyd as Kitty and her father. And he doesn't want her hanging around with the likes of these, I suppose, two blue collar working class steamboat operators. And I think it's telling that they change, or at least Willie's father does change over the course of the film without Keaton himself changing. He may change the hat. He may change the mustache. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he is still who he fundamentally is and doesn't compromise that. So I think there's so much that works about this film. Of course, it's very good. It's Keaton really at the peak of his powers in many ways. I think for me, following the General and Sherlock Jr., it was a bit of a disappointment. I think a big part of that is whether or not the humor, that character-based humor you described, really works for you. And with some exceptions that we will definitely get to, the humor just wasn't as inspired as we've seen in some of the other films. Yeah, and I think the biggest thing for me is the lack of agency with Keaton's character. At least that's the only way I can really frame it. He just isn't as compelling a character. And I think it's because of the motivation we see, for example, in something like The General, where we talked about how neatly that's set up, loving his train, loving his girl, doing anything for them. And he takes action and he intentionally and then unintentionally acts heroically. And we don't get that as much here. We get him just responding to circumstances that are more imposed on him here. And maybe that's just not as fun a Keaton for me, Josh, as it is for you.
That is so fascinating, because I think it's a major distinction between how we're experiencing Keaton and how that lands for us. Because I think you said early on, it might have been our first installment, something about him causing the chaos. And I read it as, well, actually, with Keaton, that happens on occasion. And I think you're right. The General, he does cause some chaos. But in my mind, mostly the chaos happens to Keaton. And He has to survive it somehow. And that's exactly what you just described, is that was a frustrating thing for you, where he is sort of just in a bewildered state, especially once the storm hits, right? Once the storm hits. And that's what I love about it. It's not that Keaton caused the storm. It's that he's the only one in this whole town who is maybe 60% aware of the storm. And there's something amusing to me about that. And that lack of awareness is almost why he survives. That's why he finds himself in the frame of the window as the facade falls on him, because he's not trying to escape the storm. He's just standing there. And so it's a very distinctive form of clownishness that I think Keaton has, which you're absolutely right. Other clowns, the agency they have is not so much that they have any power. That's why we laugh at them. But their agency is in creating trouble in some ways for other characters. And often in Keaton, it is the opposite, where trouble has been created and he, in a bit of a daze, wanders into it. And so it is a bit of a personal taste type thing, is how much you find that amusing as opposed to the opposite. But I do have to say, in terms of the humor, you know, something like the General did absolutely have a lot of laughs, but I thought this had way more gags and jokes in it than something like The General, which was almost more like an action adventure.
Right.
So it surprises me it struck you as less funny. But again, maybe that just comes back to like the jokes that were there didn't exactly work for you.
That's what I mean. It's the jokes themselves, not the quantity. That said, there are many very good jokes here. I think some that stand out to me, there's that wonderful moment where he has jumped aboard the King, the other boat, at night, this clandestine meeting that goes horribly wrong, and he ends up getting hit into the water. Well, actually, he hits, I think, the father into the water. I might be misremembering it, Josh, but basically two people end up in the water, mostly by accident. Here, again, he causes it, but not intentionally. And then he turns around and there's a big guy standing there, and rather than be thrown in the water, he just throws himself in the water, which I thought was great. And that bit during the storm where he ends up on the stage or backstage and is bewildered by his surroundings and actually thinks that the backdrop at one point is the outside, is nature, and tries to jump through it. There's that moment where the wind makes the ventriloquist dummy head move, you know, almost like so it's great. Possessed for a second.
Yes.
And it clearly really unnerves him, as I think it does anybody watching, because there's just something just really unnerving about dummies' heads moving. And even that final gag at the end, you know, where he jumps in the water again and we don't really know why. And it's to tie everything together the way so many of these movies and silent comedies do with a marriage. But that joke of him jumping in so he can go retrieve the priest to make it official, I thought was a nice touch.
And affirms to the audience that, yes, he is actually interested in Kitty, the Marion Byron.
Right, which is, you know, unspoken, maybe why the father partly accepts him too, right?
Yes, I think you're right about there's absolutely that insinuation about the character. And it would have been way more radical for a film of this time to just have gone with that and have been, you know, the father and son coming to terms around that reality. But I do think what we get here is pretty sweet. So you ran through so many of the good gags. One more I just want to mention. And again, these are independent of the cyclone sequence, which is so famous. We don't need to really run through any more of what happens there, but it is just astounding. I'll say that about it. But how about the early hat routine when his father takes him into the store and it's like
another one I wrote down.
The first thing we're going to do is going to get you the right hat. It's a beret he shows up in, right? I think it's a beret.
I
love the little joke where I don't think he chooses it in the end, right? He ends up going out with the beret he tucked in his back pocket, you know, reclaiming his identity. But at one point he tries on a pork pie hat, pretty sure, which is one of the things we're considering to name the awards, the pork pies. And then doesn't he try on a Charlie Chaplin style bowler type hat at one point? I just like the little, a couple, you know, Sherlock Jr. is the meta movie he made, right? And maybe why I could see that might be your favorite in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But I like those two little meta touches, nodding to himself,
yes,
and his stature as a silent comedian, and then a little nod to, you know, that other guy too.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny that he doesn't put on the pork pie hat. You think he's going to put it on and it's going to be like, oh, this feels right at home. Of course, this is my hat. And actually, it really is that kind of meta joke that he kind of just discards it,
yes,
you know, and sets it aside. Like we all know, we all get it that that's the one that he really should be wearing. Steamboat Bill Jr. is available to rent on most platforms. You may also find it at your local public library or through interlibrary loan. The final film in our marathon is 1928's The Cameraman. If you can't make it to Chicago to see it with us on Sunday, June 5th, you can find that streaming on most platforms as well. And we hope you will follow along. We will tape our discussion with Dana about The Cameraman and our Keaton Awards on the 5th. We will air that the following week. If you've got picks for your favorite Keaton performance, we haven't set the categories yet, but I'm thinking we're going to have something along the lines of the best stunt or set piece, maybe just the best gag, the funniest gag, as well as we'll do a supporting performance probably, and certainly a favorite Keaton performance. Of course, best picture as well. We'd love to hear your picks. We might even share them during the taping. Feedback at filmspotting.net. More info about our marathons is at filmspotting.net/marathons. Josh, that's our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, you can find Adam at Filmspotting and I'm at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. And that's also where you can vote in the current Film Spotting poll. It looks ahead to a top five we've got planned for next week, Movies for Graduates. We're asking, what is the best high schoolers in transition movie? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in wide release this weekend, it is time for Top Gun Maverick. You can also see Bob's Burgers, the movie. Next week here on Film Spotting, we will be sharing our top five movies for graduates.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.